KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Love Conquers Hate, a benefit for the Southern Poverty Law Center, Sunday, February 12th at 5 p.m. at the Spare Room in Portland.
Wish I could go back and take back and backtrack a million little things, but there's no new world.
Love Conquers Hate is a blues, rock, and soul benefit and consciousness-raising event. Performers include Lisa Mann, The Bar Pilots, and the Ken Deroshi Band. Again, that's Love Conquers Hate, a benefit for the Southern Poverty Law Center, Sunday, February 12th at 5 p.m. at the Spare Room, 4830 Northeast 42nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Katera Aslami Tamplin. Katera is a psychiatric survivor. She's the Consumer Empowerment Manager for Alameda County Behavioral Health Services in the Bay Area, California, and the Governor's appointee to the California Mental Health Oversight Commission. She's also the County Manager for the consumer-run Pool of Consumer Champions in Alameda County. So welcome to Madness Radio, Katera Aslami Tamplin.
Thank you, Will. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you.
It's great to have you, and I'm really interested in talking about this whole question of how we do effective advocacy at the state and county levels. You're somebody who's come out of the movement and a background in the nonprofit world, and now you're both in the grassroots movement organizing world and also in the advocacy and county politics and state politics world. Why don't we just get started? Tell us about your own process of involvement in the mental health system, how you got involved with these issues, and your own personal story around mental health.
I experienced a mental health system that was quick to diagnose me, medicate, and attempt to manage me. And that was later on in my early 20s that happened. But my story really starts also with my early childhood and my family, because I was born in Afghanistan. My family fled during the Soviet invasion of our country when I was 2 years old. And we experienced a lot of trauma trying to escape. You know, we didn't immediately come to America. We had a process, but by the time I was three, America granted us political asylum. I know right now, currently in our country, there's a lot of debate about refugees and Muslims. And I want to just speak to not only saved our lives, but I've been very fortunate to be able to give back to our community and support others. And so having fled a war-torn country, my mother and father had serious medical and psychological problems. And early on, you know, I became the primary interpreter for my parents, particularly for my mother and her psychiatric services, in addition to other healthcare appointments and needs. Starting as a young girl growing up, it was a lot of pressure. But early on, I started seeing injustices, how people treated my parents because they couldn't speak English. The community that I grew up in, Fremont, had the largest population of Afghans outside of Afghanistan. However, we did not want our problems to get out into the community, because even though everybody really escaped and experienced trauma, there was a lot of shame and self-stigma around that. So it fell upon me to be in the role of interpreter and share with the psychiatrist what was going on. And he really started off providing my mother and I with family therapy. And he was attuned to the fact that there was a definite disbalance of power in putting a kid in this kind of power position of, you know, interpreting.
What were you, like 8 years old or 7 years old or something?
Yeah. I was. And, you know, because we were, our services depended on it, my parents really worried a lot, and that was passed on to me. But it also showed me how to address issues when they came up. For example, it also showed me how to not give up. Didn't understand things. I had to find a way to get better information.
What kind of services are we talking about that you guys were dependent on?
Well, the welfare system. We were on Section 8 housing.
You really came as war refugees with almost nothing in terms of resources yourselves, sounds like.
Yeah, my father was retired in Afghanistan. My mother, when she got here, she tried to go back to work, but she had her hands trembled, and she wanted to go into cosmetology, and that didn't pan out because of her physical health conditions and her psychological condition.
And you said that you saw a lot of injustices in this whole process of interpreting and then also coming to the United States and getting services from the system.
Yeah, there was one story that stands out very vividly for me, where my mother was needed an eye exam to get correct glasses, and she had both the far and near glasses. And during the exam, the assistant did not know she had two glasses and asked her to, you know, take the eye exam. And after the first one, you know, my mom said, "This is very difficult for me. Should I wear my other glasses?" And the woman yelled at her in front of me. And I remember having to say, "I'm sorry, but that was not the appropriate thing to do, to yell at my mother for not knowing what you were expecting from her." And having to say, "Can I speak to someone else that can address this kind of unprofessional behavior?" And this was, like, at that time I was 10 years old. I had to be able to manage my emotions, which weren't always easy. But over time, I learned that if I can just make it simpler, like, okay, I need to talk to someone else, because if I keep talking to the person, it's going to build up my frustration and I will be less effective. So I just had to keep repeating, like, "Can I speak to someone else, please?"
You were brought into a family in a situation as a war refugee that really made you into an advocate and an activist from the very beginning. And so what happened? And then at some point, you yourself started to get involved in the mental health system and you yourself started to have problems, or?
I struggled with depression, long periods of sadness, anxiety, and I also, you know, was in an arranged marriage, and I did get out of it eventually. But what happened is I lost my support system, my cultural, my community. It's a taboo to get a divorce in our culture, and I felt excluded from within my community, especially my immediate family. So I went through several years of living a secret life after my divorce, where I, you know, had my own place. No one in my family knew where it was. I ended up in another bad relationship, and I was working in the mental health system as a recreational therapist, which, working within a subacute locked facility, I also, you know, saw injustices. It was hard for me to sit back and be like, "That's okay."
When you decided that you wanted to get out of this arranged marriage and go against your family and the community and the culture, how old were you then?
It was between 22 and 23.
And you ended up working in the mental health system just as a recreational therapist. Was that just because you were interested in that kind of job, or did you become a counselor at that point, or how is it that you decided to do that?
I got an opportunity at Cal State East Bay to work within the recreation department. And from that, the dean of the department recruited me into the field. And one of the internships was at the psychiatric subacute center. I mean, I didn't come in with clinical language, and I didn't know the diagnoses. I just knew this is another person that's struggling, and I want to hear their story, and I find it a privilege to hear their story. And so I just took that role, and I built relationships with and trust with the consumers that were receiving services at the center.
And when you started working in that new position, that's when you also started to see these abuses that were happening, and that just really added to the stress and struggle that you were going through at the time.
Exactly. It definitely made things much more difficult for me. And after a couple years of being the recreational therapist, I got moved up into the director position. And so it was during that transition where I was also going through my divorce.
And so in addition to all these really difficult challenges you're facing in your personal life, you're doing this work and then you're really believing and connecting with the people that you're working with, but then you're also seeing the other side of the system, the abusive side. What were some of the things that you saw that concerned you?
One of the examples that stood out for me was a young lady. She was playing loud music in her room, and it was her wellness tool, but it was bothering the staff, and they wanted her to turn it off. She wanted to play it. So their approach was, you know, five large men, and they were walking towards her room with a shot and a pill. And I knew what that meant was that they were going to give her a choice between getting a shot or taking a pill and going to what they called the quiet room. At that point, I was a rehab director, so I was able to approach the nurse, the head nurse, and say, hey, can you give me a minute? There might be a different solution. And I know he wasn't very happy with me, but he had to agree with my attempt to try to keep a bad situation from getting worse. I had already a relationship with her. I went by her bed and I sat down and I said, you know, hey, what can we do to really try to minimize the situation even further? And what do you want? And she said, I want to keep my stereo with me, and I'll be willing to walk in the other room if that's where they want me to be, but I don't want them to take my stereo away. And I said, okay, that sounds reasonable. Can I walk with you? And can we sit and continue to talk? And she said, that would be very helpful. And so with the five mental health workers and nurse standing by her door, we both walked past them. I said, you know, we're going to the other room. We'll continue talking, but I think it's okay for her to keep her stereo. And it gave her a sense of like, this is important to me. And it allowed her to voice what she wanted in this situation without it getting worse. For me, I thought everyone should be able to do that. Keep a situation from getting worse.
Because what you're describing really is not some kind of medical intervention or psychotherapy technique. What you're describing is a situation of control, that it's virtually the same scenario that one might find in a prison. And I think that the story is really powerful because we don't talk enough about how this control and abuse just makes the situation worse, how it prevents people from getting connection and help, and how it introduces a whole aspect of violence into a situation that shouldn't be there at all. And I think that's what's so frustrating. Well, wait a second, we have to look at the impact of how you provide treatment, because it's horrifying when that happens to you. It's extremely damaging and especially frustrating when there are so many alternatives that are available. So it sounds like seeing that and seeing other examples of that really showed you that the mental health system really needed some fundamental changes.
Yes, it was a very top-down approach, and our system relies on that top-down approach. And one other thing that I think is really detrimental in our system is when we assume, or we come with this belief, that the person lacks insight, and we dismiss them immediately just because they have a diagnosis, and then we take this authoritative approach, when the fact is, if we actually do listen, the person will come up with a solution. But it comes down to, do we want to listen, and how much do we value the solution that person shares with us? So I find it very difficult with that involuntary outpatient commitment laws, is that they go in there saying this person lacks insight and therefore they need someone else to make decisions for them. That is the danger, is that we're promoting this belief that people lack insight, and we're making this judgment out of fear and taking the rights away because of that fear we have.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, And our guest today is Katera Aslami Templin. She's a psychiatric survivor and the consumer empowerment manager for Alameda County Behavioral Health Services in the Bay Area, California. She's the governor's appointee to the California Mental Health Oversight Commission and county manager for the consumer-run pool of consumer champions. So you were in a situation where all these things had happened with your family, you're in the coming out of a marriage, and then you went into another difficult, abusive relationship, and all these stresses are kind of building. And now you're in this job where you're seeing these very hard things to see and witness, and the system hurting people. And it's really building up the stress. And it sounds like at some point that threw you yourself into the system.
It did. And I went in to see a psychiatrist. You know, I was just a mess. I was crying. I wanted someone to listen. And he gave me literally 5 minutes. He cut me off in the process and said, here's your diagnosis and here's your, you know, medication. Come back in 2 weeks. And that was it. And I... Oh, wow. Was stunned. And then to make the situation worse, the medication I had an allergic reaction to and actually was medically hospitalized. I definitely had a very traumatic experience.
What was the allergic reaction that you had?
Well, I got lockjaw.
It's one word, lockjaw, but that's terrifying. When your body seizes up like that, people do have muscle reactions to medications like that. It must have been very, very frightening to have that happen to you.
It was very frightening. So and of course I changed psychiatrists.
And then what happened next?
I became more interested in other approaches to addressing my mental health issues. Again, like I said, I was still in that very unhealthy relationship, and that heightened my awareness of like, I don't have the support from the relationship I'm in. So I became very determined to free myself from that in a way that was safe. And then I got more involved with Wellness Recovery Action Plan. I started attending a support group where I could speak freely and hear and gather support from. And so that's when I started becoming aware of the Alameda County pool of consumer champions, the consumer-run organizations in Alameda County. I got introduced to Jay Mahler, a pioneer in our recovery movement. I really became more interested in what are the other approaches to helping me achieve my wellness and my recovery.
Is that how you ended up eventually working as an organizer with the consumer survivor movement?
Yeah, I became involved in a consumer-run organization. And at one point, after several years of being involved with them, volunteering with them on their board, I was asked to apply for when their executive director position became available. And it was at a time where I said, you know, I really want to be in the community versus in an inpatient hospital setting. And I really want to help others connect to the community resources. And so it was the perfect timing. I got hired into it, the executive director position of the consumer-run organization. And got more involved with the pool of consumer champions also.
So why is this work important to you? I mean, why is it that you have become so involved? And what do you think is the value of having these consumer-run organizations?
Well, I think it's so important for those who have experienced the mental health system to be able to work in the field, to be able to give back to others. And I think it's critical that we have individuals that are in those positions that say, I've been there, I've done that, and recovery is possible. I think it promotes hope. It gives people a different perspective. They think differently when they know that someone else has been there, has done it, and is right there supporting them through their process. I think those roles are critical for our mental health system and for our communities. When someone gets diagnosed and they don't know that there is recovery, it does become not only an internal struggle, but it affects everything in their lives, their relationships, their jobs, their education, I mean, their social life.
You said before that a lot of this for you is about social justice and community organizing. How has that been important for you personally, and how do you see that in the organizations and the movement that you're a part of?
Well, this is a social justice movement because I think we, in the mental health system, those that have been trying to transform the mental health system, those of us that have experienced the mental health services and the mental health system, we see how in this day and age, it's the easy scapegoat. Anything that happens in the community that people don't understand, they want to find something to blame. And it seems like more and more pointing at, you know, oh, they were not diagnosed. Oh, they, you know, the mental health system failed them. And oh, and I wish the answer was that easy. It's not. And it's becoming the easy scapegoat. So not enough of our communities are hearing that perspective of, you know, there are actually effective other solutions to helping people recover. And so I feel that we have a lot of work to do to help communities look for better solutions than trying to force people into treatments and medications and dependency on a system that actually causes more problems in the long run, more trauma in the long run.
So do you see this, the scapegoating as driving a lot of the interest in involuntary commitment and the pursuit of policies like recently we've seen Alameda County adopt with involuntary commitment?
I do see it as contributing greatly to that. I also see, I mean, not only the scapegoating, but also the fear. So people are in a place where they're not thinking rationally. They're responding out of emotions, and that emotion is fear. And basing policies on fear is very dangerous. We want in Alameda County, and I know nationally, we want more services, but we want the services that will help people.
So to take a kind of a devil's advocate point of view, we've got people on the streets who are living out under freeway overpasses, who are in the bushes behind government buildings, who are living rough. They seem obviously mentally ill or obviously crazy, and these people need help, and we are seeing them go into our prison system, which is terrible. We don't know what to do with them, and we think that just grabbing them and putting them into the hospital is the most humane thing to do, because ultimately it's in their best interest to get them back in touch with reality. What would you say to that devil's advocate?
I would say before we would take that kind of approach, why wouldn't we try to give that person a peer specialist that checks in with them, that builds a relationship with them, and that maybe starts to just give them their basic needs? The hospital is not the long-term solution. Housing is the long-term solution. So there are ways where we can engage people and start providing for their basic needs within this involuntary outpatient commitment stuff. The court process is about like $20,000 to $30,000 per person. I can't help but think, okay, offer them the support, offer them the like voluntary services. But how about instead of the court process, say, if you accept these voluntary services that are like, you know, going to give you someone you can connect with, that you could talk to, that will bring, you know, a blanket or food for you here and there. And then how about offer them, instead of that court process, a safe place to live in?
And let's talk about that a little bit, about the role of money in this. This is all explained in terms of, well, this is the best interests of patients and their families. But you've also suggested that there's a lot of people who stand to make a lot of money from involuntary outpatient commitment and the use of force. How does that come in as a factor here?
Really, what it is it's the easier approach for the provider. I don't have to work harder to engage you, to try to build trust, to try to bring you to our services. I could just use this threat that if you don't comply, I have this court order, could take you back to the judge or take you back to the psychiatric emergency room. And if you don't have to spend time in building a relationship and building trust and providing services that, you know, that is person-centered, then you're making a profit from services that in the end, really, it creates a consistent customer and a court ordered customer.
So Katera, tell us a bit about your work locally and statewide.
Well, my work locally in Alameda County is with the county behavioral health care system, and I bring the recovery vision to the leadership there, and I also bring the voice of the consumer survivors in the community that I work with to the leadership table. So when policies and decisions are made, not only is the community informed, but then the policies are informed by what the community feels and is appropriate and is not. And we work with the consumer-run organizations in our county and the efforts to really further bringing people together, identifying problems, looking for solutions, and really finding ways to outreach, educate, and get people involved in transforming the mental health system. So that's what the Pool of Consumer Champions we do. It's got 1,015 members, mental health survivors who have joined, and we employ them to run it. So it's really ran by the people. It's just rich with the involvement of the people that it serves. So we work collaboratively, and we're very involved in our community, and we're involved in the state level. So part of my work at the state level on the Mental Health Oversight and Accountability Commission is I sit in the seat of someone who's experienced the mental health system, and to be able to make sure that our state oversight of our county services and what the voters of California voted for, which was Proposition 63, the Mental Health Services Act, is aligned with the peer vision that is about engaging the users of mental health services and their families and making sure that our system is accountable and helping people recover.
So the Mental Health Services Act was a specific fund that was established by the state, and it was intended to go into mental health innovations, is that right?
Community mental health services and innovations is one of the components. Yeah, there's several components within the Mental Health Services Act. Innovations is one, prevention and early intervention is another, community services and supports, technology, and you know, improving our ability to provide and gather data is another area. And then the last but not least is workforce education and training. And so these components were written within the Mental Health Services Act, which is a really transformative law that was passed, again, by the voters of California and the legislators.
Katera, we are just about out of time. If people want to find out more about your work, more about the Pool of Consumer Champions and the involuntary outpatient commitment struggle in Alameda County and around the country, and they want to get in touch with you, how should they follow up with that?
They can definitely visit us at www.pocc.org. My email is kasam lam as in Mary, I at acbhcs.org. So people can email me, and you can find me on Facebook. It's Katera Aslami Tamplin. I'm easily accessible, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that people have.
Katera Aslami Tamplin, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Katera Aslami Tamplin. She's a psychiatric survivor and consumer empowerment manager for Alameda County Behavioral Health Services in the Bay Area, California. She's the governor appointee to the California Mental Health Oversight Commission and the county manager for the Pool of Consumer Champions. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall, and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, February 6th, 2017. In local news, heavy rains on Sunday overwhelmed Portland's sewer system, causing raw sewage to overflow into the Willamette River. After the spill, the Portland Bureau of Environmental Services issued a warning to residents to avoid contact with the river until 48 hours after the spill ends. The city has yet to announce the spill had ended. The releases were estimated to be 80% rainwater and 20% raw sewage, with the overflows beginning near the Ross Island Bridge and extending downstream. While Portland still averages 5 sewage overflows a year, the number is down to 1/10 of the number of spills that used to occur before the city upgraded its sewer system. Dubbed the Big Pipe, in 2011, the city completed a $1.4 billion project that upgraded the sewage system in Portland. Previous raw sewage releases occurred last Thanksgiving and in mid-January of 2017. In more local news, last week, a new emergency psychiatric hospital opened in Portland and began accepting both transfer and walk-in patients experiencing a mental health crisis. The new $40 million facility is a partnership between Legacy,